Hello, welcome to Convergent Dialogues. This is Xavier Bonilla. On this episode, I'm very happy to be talking with Cole Bunzel. Cole is a historian and fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He studies history and contemporary affairs of the Islamic Middle East, with a particular focus on violent Islamism and the Arabian Peninsula. He's got a master's in international relations from Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and a bachelor's and PhD in Near Eastern Studies from Princeton University. He's been a research fellow in Islamic law and civilization at the Yale Law School, and is a non-resident fellow at the George Washington University Program on Extremism. He's an editor of the blog Jihadica and has written widely on the ideology of Sunni jihadism, including his most recent book, Wahhabism, The History of a Militant Islamic Movement. And that's what we're talking about in this conversation. We start by talking about the current landscape of Wahhabism, extreme and non-extreme uses of Wahhabism, and some of the differences between some of the terrorist organizations that use Wahhabism for their own agenda. We're talking about the founder, Al-Wahhab, and how he started a movement, how he modeled himself after the Prophet Muhammad, being against polytheism and the cult of saints. This is some of the doctrinal issues on what Wahhabism is centered around, and why Wahhabism was designed to be aggressive. We also discuss the critics of Wahhabism from the beginning, the role of Sufism, major doctrines, the three Saudi states, the legacy of Wahhabism, and many other topics. This was a fantastic conversation, very illuminating, clarified a lot of things. It was super essential. And I think one of the critical things is that we decided to start the conversation by talking about kind of stuff people will see in the news or more recently in the past 20 years as a way to kind of connect, you know, okay, here's how we see it. Or some versions of it today, and how do we see the backstory of this? Where does this come from with this ideology, and how it's used, inaccurately or whatever? And so, I thought that was really, really helpful. Cole is great. He's obviously very brilliant, super knowledgeable, wonderful guy, and I was very, very happy with the conversation, and hopefully it can be very, very helpful for all the listeners out there. As always, you can find this conversation and all other conversations at convergentdialogues.substack.com, also on YouTube. So get over there, subscribe, follow, like, share, all the things. And big, big thanks to people that have listened, follow, and also contribute as well. It keeps the show going, and it's always a blessing and honor to have people contribute in different ways. So big thanks there. And now I bring you Cole Bunzel.
I'm here with Cole Bunzel. Cole, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I'm really, really looking forward to our conversation.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've written a really wonderful book. The book is called Wahhabism, The History of a Militant Islamic Movement, out of the great Princeton University Press. And we're going to talk all about it. Before we do, why don't you tell listeners who you are academically, professionally, and all the relevant points that you want to share with us.
Okay, so for the past 4 or so years, I've been a fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, where I write about history of the Middle East, particularly Saudi Arabia, including the Wahhabi movement, which emerged in Saudi Arabia in the 18th century. And I also study the dynamics of Islamism, contemporary Islamism, including the jihadi movement associated with Al-Qaeda and ISIS. So that's more or less my area of interest. And before that, I did a PhD in Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University, and I was a fellow at Yale Law School a year after that. Mm. That's where I come from. Mm. And I've spent time living in the region. I lived in Syria for a year after college in Damascus studying Arabic. And most of the time that I've spent in the region since then has been primarily in Saudi Arabia.
Nice. I was going to ask, do you speak Arabic or loosely enough?
Inshallah. fairly well, I hope.
Oh, good. Yes. Good. That's great. That's great. That's great. That's great. Well, you're dealing with a lot of original sources, so I'm assuming you got to be halfway decent at it. That's cool that you were able to stay in Damascus. I've obviously a lot of Westerners don't get there. But it's such an ancient city. It's got so much history. It's got so many things there. So quite lucky to spend some time there. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Lucky to have that experience because most people can't have it right now.
No.
I'm certainly not going to Damascus anytime soon, unfortunately.
Yeah. So Wahhabism. So this is an interesting kind of subgrouping of Islam, of course, and it's not old. Islam is, but I think one of the things that will be interesting is to know kind of a little bit how more modern this is, and we'll talk all about it. But before we do, I thought it would be a good idea to talk about present time. Where do we see the tenets and or beliefs of Wahhabism in the region, so the Mideast and globally, and where do we see how it's implemented in its practice at present in the region and in the world?
Okay, so in its origins in the mid 18th century, Wahhabism was what I describe it, a militant Islamic movement, to mean that it was quite radical, provocative, activist. It wasn't content with the status quo, and it aimed at shaking things up, at drawing a stark line between believers and unbelievers. And in the Wahhabi worldview, most of the world's professed Muslims were not, in fact, Muslims. They were polytheists on account of their participation in what is called in Western academia the cult of saints, which is the idea of visiting the shrines and graves of dead saints or prophets and asking them for worldly favors or heavenly reward, intercession with God, things like that. So it starts off very, very militant, and it's very divisive and controversial. But just to zoom up to the current day, what you have in contemporary Saudi Arabia, so the Wahhabi movement gave birth to the early Saudi state in the 18th century. And then there was a second Saudi state in the 19th century, and a third Saudi state that begins in the early 20th century in 1902, becomes the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And it always had a very close relationship to this controversial version of Islam known as Wahhabism. What happens beginning in around the 1920s and 30s is that the king of what soon became Saudi Arabia, he kind of imposed a toned down version of this version of Islam on the scholars. He basically told them, we're going to normalize relations with the rest of the Islamic world. We're going to, you know, have conferences with Muslim scholars of different creeds and persuasions, and you're going to have to be on board with this. So basically he tamed Wahhabism. He toned it down. And so you had this kind of stripped down, less militant version of Wahhabism, which was in place for especially the latter half of the 20th century. But the legitimacy of the Saudi state was always premised on having a relationship with this movement known as Wahhabism, and the scholars who were its main representatives, who were the descendants of the founder of the movement. They're called the El-Sheikh, or the family of the Sheikh. But what MBS has done, and this is the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, since when he came, I think he became crown prince in 2017 or so, he has been gradually and then suddenly kind of pushing Wahhabism away from the foundational narrative of the state. So there are two ways to look at what's going on with Wahhabism today. I think one is that Saudi Arabia is increasingly distancing itself from this militant heritage. It's a problematic heritage. MBS doesn't want to have this baggage of a militant Islamic past. He's rewriting history. The textbooks are being rewritten so that the history of the original Saudi polity in the 18th century begins before Wahhabism. So he's trying to kind of create a new nationalism that is projected backwards. And at the same time, you have the jihadi movement associated with Al-Qaeda and ISIS that has grabbed onto the Wahhabi movement for its essentially its theology. So they are constantly appealing, that is the leaders or the scholars associated with Al-Qaeda and ISIS, they're constantly appealing to the texts and the traditions and the scholars of the militant Wahhabi heritage from the 18th to the early 20th century. So if you read, and this is partly how I got interested in this subject, is if you read some of these texts, particularly beginning in the 1980s by what were then, we could call them proto-jihadi scholars, the people who are supporting movements like Al-Qaeda and what would then become ISIS, they are constantly citing these Wahhabi authorities. And the Wahhabi authorities are essentially saying the same thing from the 18th century to the early 20th century, and that is that you have to draw a stark line between believers and unbelievers. We have to have a strong emphasis on pure monotheism or tawhid. And we have to enforce the boundaries of that line. So if you are a polytheist, if you indulge what is in the Wahhabi or the jihadi view, polytheism of any kind, and that can include support for elections or nationalism, then you are beyond the pale and you ought to be fought in jihad and to be shown enmity and hatred, etc. So that's sort of the terrain of Wahhabism as it exists today.
So let me ask you, is it fair to say at present that for Al-Qaeda and ISIS, the tenets and the tradition and the if you will, doctrines of Wahhabism is, that's what they follow. That's what's animating, or that's what's giving them license, if you will, to wage, you know, jihad, an offensive jihad, and do all of their activities against many individuals, including other Muslims. Is that fair to say, or is that too direct of a link there?
So the link is very direct, but I don't think we should kind of discount the other elements that go into the jihadi ideology and worldview, which include the idea of restoring the caliphate and fighting regimes that don't apply Islamic law and that rule with democracy. So a lot of those things are kind of absent from the Wahhabi heritage. Mm-hmm. The fierce intolerance of Muslims of other theological persuasions, those who indulge in practices perceived as polytheistic in some sense, that is very much coming straight out of the Wahhabi heritage. And the Wahhabi heritage is, I think, particularly appealing to them because not only is it extremely intolerant and uncompromising in its fundamental tenets, but it also isn't tainted by Western colonialism or anything like that. So there's no, in the history of Wahhabism, isn't a history of confrontation with the West. It's an internal Islamic world phenomenon, a battle over, you know, what Islam ought to be or and what it is not. And so, I mean, that tradition, I think it rings to the ears of the jihadis as pristine and untainted, as I said.
Yeah, that's a helpful distinction, I guess, to further clarify here. So there is some use of it, but is it more of that for, I mean, what many people deem terrorists or terrorist groups, such as Al-Qaeda and ISIS, is it that they're just interpreting or even maybe misinterpreting the tenets of Wahhabism, or they're just using it in their way? That, to say in another way, there are other people that could believe it, and you don't have what many of these terrorist groups are using it for. Is it an interpretive thing, or is it, no, actually the way in which you would interpret this would be elements of, you know, some extremism or some militant kinds of ways of thinking or et cetera. So is it just an interpretive thing that, you know, ISIS is taking this and running with it? Or is that kind of endogenous to the actual ideas and doctrine of Wahhabism?
I think more the latter. I mean, so say you take the early Islamic textual tradition comprising the Quran and the Sunnah. And you can, if you wanted to kind of formulate a political movement from that, there are many ways you can go, right? You can look for verses that emphasize peace or verses that emphasize war, verses that emphasize obedience, ones that tell you about the limits of obedience, things like that. It's much harder to kind of find ambiguity in the Wahhabi heritage. There's a very, very strong emphasis throughout, from the earliest writings of the founder to the earlier 20th century, that those who disagree with our approach to Islam are unbelievers, they're polytheists, and it is a duty for good, true Muslims to shun them, to show them hatred and enmity, to pronounce takfir or excommunication on them, to fight, ideally to fight them in jihad. I mean, these are repeated ad nauseum. I mean, this is a tradition that is kind of, you could say, just ready-made for a jihadi type of movement in the contemporary world. Even if there are things in the tradition or in the modern world that weren't a part of the context of Wahhabism, like I said, democracy, for instance. So the jihadis, one of their biggest issues, one of the things that they write about the most, is the fact that democracy is, in their view, a religion, a polytheistic religion, because it gives every human being the ability to determine what is law, whereas according to Islam, there's only one law, God's law, the Sharia. Mm-hmm. So that was not at the center of the Wahhabi history. What they were most concerned about, the Wahhabi scholars, that is, was polytheism in the sense of the cult of saints, of venerating saints and asking them for favors. There are, however, instances when Wahhabi scholars, particularly beginning in the later 19th century, they had exposure to Ottoman reform and the ways that law was being canonized. And in their view, this was European qawaneen or positive law, and therefore that was also a version of polytheism. So there is, there is kind of a logic to the way that the jihadis look at this tradition. Mm.
So if it is sort of kind of endemic to the ideas, is there? I mean, obviously, there's the extreme version. People that are committing acts of terror, and you're using this. Is there a way? So you were saying, I mean, we'll talk about the history of this, but there's where it starts, and then progressively over the 19th and 20th century, a kind of slow, kind of trying to reform it or make it more watered down. And now you have something more modern where MBS is trying to, essentially, it sounds like, do away with it. Is there, I guess, what does it look like? Or give us, a picture of someone that is not a terrorist or does not belong to a terrorist organization, but they do believe the tenets of Wahhabism. Does that exist? Is that a kind of...
Oh, sure.
Yeah, what does that look then, of sorts?
Well, it looks like some of the leading scholars in Saudi Arabia who have long been associated with the royal family, like Saleh al-Fawzan, for instance. These are men who have spent their lives kind of decoding and writing commentaries on Wahhabi texts. But the way that they do this is they try to put things into context. So, the most radical Wahhabi texts are shown to have been written in a context of war or something like that. To me, it's not very persuasive. I find that they have been tasked with justifying and rearticulating Wahhabism in a way that is less aggressive. Whereas the foundational texts are quite clear in what it is that a good Muslim is supposed to do. And that is to be kind of a rabble rouser, to make trouble, to get in the face of those who are perceived to be polytheists or committing polytheism, to pronounce takfir on them, to divide society. It's a very divisive heritage. I mean, they exist. I'm not saying most people who adhere to Wahhabi ideas, they're probably not focused on the most militant texts. There are certain texts written in this tradition that don't emphasize, the militant kind of activism that is at the heart of a lot of it. And so you can sort of skip over it, or you can kind of take for example, a line that says a Muslim does not become, his faith is incomplete until he shows enmity and hatred to the unbelievers. Mm. I mean, one could just say, yeah, that's true, without emphasizing that one, that those reading those lines have to actually go and engage in that act. Mm. So I don't know if that helps.
No, that does help, because it does sound like there is, I mean, you see this with a lot of religions, especially when older ones, where it does sound like there is a kind of an omission that's happening, right? We're going to actively not, we're just going to glide over this, or we're going to de-emphasize this part of it and choose the parts we do like. But then you will have, you know, essentially true believers, fundamentalists, that take it all the way. It's like, look, it's the 7th century, and we're, you know, in this case, in the 19th century, 18th century, it's going to be, you know, we're just going to follow what was said and how this was done. So it does seem interesting how, you know, the reason why I think a lot of people might be interested in some of this is, well, we do see acts of terror by certain groups, and it's like, well, what's the ideology, right? This has to come from somewhere. And it's not enough to say, well, this is their interpretation of the Quran or various hadiths. It's like, well, what's the system? Where is this coming from? And I think that's why it becomes, you know, for better or for worse, more evergreen to understand this kind of system of an ideology that's reading various texts in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And to say, okay, now let's make a caveat here, of course. This is not the majority of Muslims around the world. Even with people that believe in Wahhabism, it sounds like they're not emphasizing many of these extreme components. So we are talking about a small group of people, it sounds like, in terms of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, but unfortunately, very loud and very destructive group of people that are adhering to this way of believing it. Is that about right? That kind of overarching kind of picture of how we see this, or am I off on something? Am I missing something?
Yeah, I think that's essentially right. And I should perhaps make a further distinction, since we're focusing in on the modern era right now. There is a distinction between Al-Qaeda and ISIS when it comes to the appeal to Wahhabism in particular, because Wahhabism is it's the epitome of intolerance. So it's very popular, for instance, for ISIS, what we now call ISIS-K, or the branch of ISIS in Afghanistan. They have decided that the Taliban are unbelievers, that they're polytheists. And a lot of the way that they justify this is by appealing to Wahhabi texts, which are very intolerant of groups that adhere to different philosophies of Islam.
Why do they feel the Taliban are this way? What is the actions that the Taliban is doing or not doing that make them view this?
Well, they've written about this at extreme length in different languages. But to put it in as few words as possible, the Taliban, one has to understand, they don't belong to a Salafi Wahhabi background. Their background is Sunni Islam, but it's a different kind of Sunni Islam than what one finds dominant in the Arab world. So they belong to something called Hanafi Maturidism, to put it bluntly. I mean, that's the way that the jihadis of ISIS look at it. So they come at it, their tradition is one that follows the Hanafi Madhab, one of the four schools of law in Sunni Islam. And that is that follows the Maturidi school of theology, which is a rationalist theological tradition associated with the Hanafi school of law. And so this is, you know, this goes back into theological polemics of the, you know, 13th to 14th centuries and earlier, where you had people like Ibn Taymiyyah, who is, we can talk about him a little later, kind of sort of the godfather of Salafi purist Sunni Islam. He had lots of diatribes against the types of theologians associated with Maturidism. So the Maturidis and the idea that the Hanafis, they follow blindly in the jihadi view, the teachings of their law school, that immediately renders them beyond the pale. Mm. So it's kind of hard. I've written a little bit about this in a separate essay. One can go back to the 1990s and find jihadi Arabs living in the vicinity of Afghanistan who are already deeply uncomfortable with the Afghan approach to Islam, mm. because they see it in just these terms, Hanafi, Maturidi. There's also a mix of Sufism. If the Taliban are not Sufis themselves, they're at the very least tolerant of Sufi practices and rituals, including the cult of saints. Mm. Here we go with modern Islam digressions before we even get to the heart of the book. But another fun fact that I like to throw out there sometimes is that the chief judge of the Taliban, he's a close confidant of the current supreme leader and the former supreme leader of the Taliban, Mullah Omar. This is a judge named Abdul Hakim al-Haqqani. And he's written several books, not even several, he's written dozens of books on Islamic law, theology, and ethics, etc. Interesting character, total misogynist. But one of the most interesting passages I found in one of his books has to do with his comments on Wahhabism. When it comes to describing Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab, he dismisses the man as a heretic, someone who declared takfir on the Muslim world. And, you know, just some, and thank God that the Ottomans came and destroyed the early Saudi state. So this is a militant Sunni fundamentalist movement, the Taliban, the United States was at war with for 20 odd years. Mm-hmm. And they are theologically incompatible with another Sunni militant fundamentalist movement that the United States is at war with, ISIS. Al-Qaeda is somewhere in between. Mm. And they're trying to constantly appeal to a kind of pan-Islamic sentiment and not put as much emphasis on sectarian division. And that's sort of a new theme in Al-Qaeda. So they've kind of moved away from the Wahhabism, whereas ISIS has picked up that mantle.
Not to divert more, but where do we find, you can just plug it in where it kind of fits here, if at all. Where do we, I mean, it's, you know, kind of relevant at the moment. Where do Hezbollah and Hamas fit in this kind of picture as well? Are they also a kind of Islamic fundamentalist kind of, you know, groups as well, or is it completely removed?
Yeah, I would also classify them as Islamic fundamentalist movements, but of a different, you know, cut from a different cloth, and each from its own cloth. Mm. The Hamas is an extension of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. It's quite clear about that in its charter. And it's a mixture of traditional Muslim Brotherhood themes about Islamic revival and, you know, restoring Islamic sovereignty to the world, etc., and Palestinian national liberation. So it has an interesting background, but it's not related to Wahhabism. Mm. In fact, it's been at war with groups that that have, in the Gaza Strip in particular, have tried to assert their authority, mm. Mainly groups associated with what were then associated with Al-Qaeda. Mm. And Hezbollah is, of course, a Shiite movement, and that is, you know, has its origins in Lebanon in the 1980s, and is associated with the revolutionary theocratic ideals of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Mm-hmm. So there's the completely incompatible, yeah, with Wahhabism. So yeah, it's interesting that, you know, some people will like to talk about Islamic, a kind of general war against Islamic fundamentalism or something like that. But I think that once you kind of look behind the curtain a little bit, you find that these groups, these movements are all very, very different. Very much so at odds with one another, fighting each other, engaging in ideological polemic left and right every day, tweet after tweet, telegram post after telegram post. And I write about some of this stuff, and it's it can be fun, it can be nauseating, but it's never uninteresting.
Yeah, I appreciate you making those distinctions, because I think some people like to really, well, some people like to flatten these groups and people in two ways. Some people will say very, very, very recklessly about, you know, Islam as a religion. That's just a, what I've learned is that's wildly reckless. You know, most people are not in these kind of camps. But even specific to that is, you can talk about Islamic fundamentalist or extremist or terrorists and terrorist groups. But as you're pointing out, they're not all the same, and in fact are in opposition to each other. You cannot say that because, okay, yes, there's interpretations or there's ways in which they're reading various texts, but they are not all, you know, just joined together and, you know, against the West or against, you know, anyone else as this common enemy. It is very much very complicated. And they all have their own interests and they all have their own ways of doing things. And I think typically what happens for people in the West is they just see the behaviors and the actions, and then it's tied to interpretation of a religion. And so it's just like, you know, very much making, at the very least, correlations. And, you know, maybe I think some of that's unfair, maybe some of it is fair, but I think it is really important to be careful to say, okay, here's where there are distinctions. Even within Wahhabism, there is folks that aren't doing this kind of extreme kind of practice. So
I think there's also, I think some, you know, people, not just Westerners, but, you know, modern day people brought up in, you know, generally secular society have a hard time wrapping their heads around the idea that, you know, the different, you know, religious groups would want to kill each other over things like the interpretation of God's attributes in the Quran and things like that. But, you know, we have that history in Christian, Christendom, Christian civilization as well, you know, with all of the polemics over transubstantiation, which I couldn't even begin to understand or decipher. But people, you know, killed each other over that sort of thing and divided into sects. And that's our history.
Yeah. I mean, you just go to the schism, was it 1066 or whatever? And then the Reformation, then you get the Enlightenment. I mean, yeah, in Christianity, there's a long history of
and it wasn't all polite.
No. it certainly wasn't. There's been some violent periods for Christendom as well. So I guess we kind of really, you know, in some ways set the kind of impact here, but we can go back now and talk about kind of how this starts and where does this all come from. So you talk about the main founder and you talk about Al-Wahhab, is this right? And
the proper way to say his name is Ibn Abdul Wahhab.
Okay.
He's the son of the servant of Al-Wahhab. It's like, so.
Okay. And tell
but you can call him Wahhab. I don't mind.
No, it's good.
I'll call him Ibn Abdul Wahhab.
Yeah. I like the accuracy. So tell us, I guess, just like, what, you don't have to give us a kind of the whole background and how he was raised. And all this. My understanding from the book is that he was raised to be a religious scholar from an early age, kind of ensconced in this. You know, you can talk about where there are kind of always these inklings of this kind of radicalism, but more so, where do we start to see? It's always fascinating how a movement can start from a charismatic figure or a very dogmatic figure, you know, things like that. But how does how do we get to this space where he starts having these ideas, these teachings, and then how he begins to build a movement? So just kind of tell us a little bit, just him, and then how this kind of gets to the point where it's a movement.
Yeah, so the beginning of his movement, which just for to pause on a matter of terminology, we talk about Wahhabism, that term, which is al-Wahhabiyya in Arabic, it's a name that refers to the movement begun by the predicatory or preaching movement begun by Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab when he began it in the 1740s, and also refers to the doctrinal content of his movement. So that's typically when scholars are talking about Wahhabism. Wahhabis, you can imagine, are not too keen on that term. But their alternative is Islam, which isn't very helpful. So sometimes they refer to it as a dawah and najdiya, or the najdi call or mission. That has to do with the fact that this movement began in an area of the Arabian Peninsula known as Najd. So that's the central part of the Arabian Peninsula, which is largely desert. It's made up of a large plateau. This is the area where Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, is today. If you look at a map, it is very much so mostly desert. And at the time when Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab was raised, I think he was born in about 1703, he was brought up, however, not in the desert, but as part of settled society. So there were these settlements and different agricultural oases, and he belonged to one that was called El Oyena. So he was born in a town called El Oyena, which was one of the leading towns of Najd, and he belonged to a scholarly family, meaning that his father was a judge, a Muslim judge, a Qadi. His grandfather was an even more prestigious judge. So he had a very strong pedigree. However, he does not seem to have been impressed in the slightest with the level of Islamic learning that his family possessed. And we don't know exactly when he began to have these views, very peculiar to his contemporaries, about the nature of Tawheed and whatnot. But he begins his movement, all of the sources are basically unanimous, that he begins his movement at the moment his father dies, or shortly after his father dies, which is in 1741. So he's about 38 years old or 40 years old, probably in a Hijri calendar. And then this kind of relates to another theme that you might, I think you had in our outline about the resemblances or the modeling after the Prophet Muhammad. Mm-hmm. So the Prophet Muhammad was 40 when he had his first revelations, mm-hmm. began preaching. Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab was also about 40 when he began preaching. Mm-hmm. And he saw the state of the world that he was preaching in, that is Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab, as quite similar to the state of affairs that the Prophet Muhammad was preaching in. He saw that the world of Islam had degenerated into one in which various forms of polytheism reigned supreme. In particular, this these set of rituals that I referred to earlier, known as the cult of saints. In Arabic, it would be ziyarat al-qubur, or the visitation of graves. And so he polemicized at length against this, and he wrote that this was not consistent with the Islamic idea of Tawheed or monotheism. And he began to write epistles and to preach about his interpretation of Tawheed. And what he wrote at that time, and we are able from some of the refutations written against him to kind of timestamp these epistles that he wrote, he was writing that all worship must be owed to God alone. So there's And he's drawing ideas here from Ibn Taymiyyah, who was an earlier scholar from the 13th and 14th century, who was from Syria, who had controversial ideas about Tawheed. He actually had quite similar views, mm-hmm. almost identical views to the cult of saints. Mm-hmm. He was equally intolerant of the cult of saints, except Ibn Taymiyyah didn't begin a radical reformist movement around that. So this is what Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab did. Is he kind of condensed a lot of Ibn Taymiyyah's theological views into very easily digestible bullet points, which he would send in epistles to different communities or different preachers, and he would try to convince people that the predominant practices of not just the Islamic world of Najd that they lived in, but in the metropolitan centers of Iraq and Syria and elsewhere, that these amounted to polytheism or shirk. And therefore, the people who were partaking in those practices were not Muslims. They were actually polytheists, much like the polytheists that the Prophet Muhammad was arrayed against at the time when he was preaching. Because according to Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab, those polytheists at the time of the Prophet in the 6th and 7th centuries, they also believed in one God. They professed a kind of basic monotheism, but they prayed to many gods. So there was this distinction that he drew between two kinds of Tawheed, which comes from Ibn Taymiyyah. And he wanted to kind of explain to the people of his day that to be true Muslims, you had to you had to profess Tawheed in the second way, which was to direct all forms of worship to God alone. And that includes supplication or praying to graves and that sort of thing. That is no bueno for Ibn Abd al-Wahhab. And then that, in the second part, so that was the first part of his message, if we are going to condense it into two things. One is a lot of what you see today is shirk. It's not tawheed. To profess tawheed correctly, you have to direct all forms of worship to God alone. The second plank of his platform was that to profess that was actually not sufficient to make one a Muslim. One had to go further and take another step by showing hatred and enmity to the polytheists in one's midst. And this was also, according to Ibn Abd al-Wahhab, the practice of the Prophet Muhammad and prophets and messengers before him. So that was sort of, in essence, the message that he was preaching from the earliest epistles that we have by him from 1742. That's the earliest one that I was able to timestamp.
So a bunch of follow-ups here. So the first one I have is there, in one way you could look at this, you know, he's basically ripping off of the Prophet Muhammad and some of the earlier teacher that you mentioned from the 13th century. Is he really offering anything new? Or a second way of looking at this is that the point? That if someone's going to believe somebody and he's going to start a movement, you have to connect it to the very heart and core of the religion and the doctrines and all that. So I guess the question here is, you could look at it one of two ways, but was what he was doing by aligning with definitely the Prophet Muhammad and also with others, in terms of doctrine, was that intentional so people would say, you can't necessarily disagree with that. You have to agree with it. So now we're getting this updated reading or version that's going to have a lot of weight behind it. What's the view there?
So his contemporaries were deeply offended.
You can see that too, right? Yeah, you could be offended. Yeah.
They're being called polytheists by someone that, you know, a lot of them didn't see as a supremely talented scholar. And Muhammad Abd al-Wahhab was many things. We probably wouldn't call him a genius. He didn't write, you know, tomes in different Islamic sciences or anything like that. He was very limited to what he knew best, and that was creed or theology, the fundamentals of the faith. So he would be criticized by contemporary scholars who would say, you don't meet the level to be a mujtahid, the kind of scholar who can draw directly from the Islamic texts. You're an imposter. How dare you accuse us of being unbelievers? So that was one angle, you know, the scholars trying to diminish him. But just, I think more generally, people saw him as, you know, comparing the polytheists mentioned in the Quran to, you know, professed Muslims of the 18th century. And these are people who follow the Quran, accept the Quran, and they said, how dare you? Mm. I mean, how dare you compare us to that? Mm. So, you know, but of course, I think from the other angle, from the Wahhabi angle, this was exactly the point. It was very persuasive for Muhammad Abd al-Wahhab to draw that connection because, I mean, clearly he was able to found a movement, and one should emphasize that the movement that he founded predates the Saudi political enterprise by several years. So he was able to have the good fortune in approximately 1744, 45 of gaining the support of a man named Muhammad bin Saud in the town called Diriyah. And that is sort of the foundation of the first Saudi state, which is generated by Wahhabism and adopts Wahhabism as its foundational religious ideology. But the movement precedes that, and he's able to gather a whole lot of followers on the basis of these divisive ideas. So he was able to convince a lot of the people around him that their religious practices in Najd in particular amounted to polytheism, and that the people engaged in those practices were akin to the polytheists mentioned in the Quran.
So two things that come out is he's very, in terms of, we'll get to the core components in a minute, but the things that stick out are he's very much against polytheist and definitely seemingly polytheist internally within Islam, much less than those that are outside Islam. What does that, so, I mean, I know what that, for me, I know what that means, right? You believe in many gods, right? Like that's what it is, right? That's polytheism. You believe, so if you, you know, for yeah. Muslims, it's Allah is the one true God. For Jews, it's Yahweh. For Christians, it's, you know, God and, you know, the Trinity and all that. So like, yeah, there's like the one God, but like my impression from reading the book and a little bit here is polytheism had a very broad definition. Like what's included in polytheism seems pretty wide. What did he mean by polytheism? What's included in that and or not included in that? Because that's, to me, what's seemingly becoming a sticking point for some people.
Yeah, and it certainly was a sticking point at the time. So the Arabic word that I use, that I translate as polytheism, is shirk. And that means an Arabic association or associationism. So it's short for the association of other beings or things with God. And the way that the Wahhabis interpret it in particular is the association of other beings in the worship of God, sometimes known as shirk fil ibadah or shirk polytheism in worship. So it's not a perfect translation by any means. Some use associationism. I'm not too hot on that, though. It's not really an English term. But the important thing is that for Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab, the way that that one becomes a polytheist is not by believing in the existence of many gods, but by appealing to more than one divine authority. So as he sees it, somebody who is dead, say a saint, who go to that grave and they believe that this saint is capable of miracles. Say, if I pray to this saint and I might even put some money in the tomb, this saint is going to protect me, from famine or from being pillaged on my next caravan, that sort of thing. There are similar things in the Catholic tradition.
I was going to ask about this. Yeah. Understanding of saints is from I mean, I'm not Catholic, I never was, but what my understanding of saints is that very similar. You pray, you burn a candle, you have, you know, sometimes a day for the saints, and they help you with something specific, and there's a saint for this and a saint for this. Is it somewhat analogous? I mean, I don't want to compare because I know different religions, different history and background stuff, but is there some analogous elements of sainthood?
It is somewhat analogous, and you know, I couldn't get into the, I don't know enough about the details of the Christian case to expound upon the analogy, but there's certainly something there, and that was what was deeply offensive to Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab, and he wasn't the first to draw that connection, to be offended by that. His predecessor, the most important predecessor, was Ibn Taymiyyah, 14th century Muslim scholar from Syria, who I mentioned before, who wrote, he polemicized at great length against the cult of saints. However, he was much more restrained when it came to pronouncing takfir, excommunication, on those who were seen as participating in the cult of saints.
So is this for Taymiyyah and for Wahhab, is this cult of saints idea, it's not the only way that they're looking at polytheism. Is there other ways, or at least for Wahhab, is there, other things that are there? I mean, it sounds like the cult of saints is an essential bit of it, but it's not the only thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, it's not the only thing. There's a book that Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab wrote called Kitab al-Tawhid, the Book of Monotheism, in which he goes through chapter by chapter, different, kind of phenomena of polytheism as he saw them in his time. So the things would include sorcery, witchcraft, appealing to or praying at trees. This was actually like holy trees. People would put like little pieces of paper or something on a tree and think that it would give them good luck. All things like that. There's a story in the earliest Wahhabi chronicle about Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab chopping down a tree that was seen as a holy tree. Also, breaking down grave sites, things like that. So, and those who have focused on Kitab al-Tawheed, I think, kind of miss the fact that it is the cult of saints that's at the center of this. Because if you examine, I think the best way to look at how Wahhabism kind of worked in practice is to look at the writings of Ibn Abdul Wahhab that he was sending to his contemporaries. That is his epistles and his letters. What was he trying to convince them of? And in those letters and in those epistles, what one definitely finds the emphasis on is the cult of saints and the fact that it amounts to shirk or polytheism or the sharing and the worship of God, because all things must be directed to God, all forms of worship. And he repeatedly goes after this theme. It's not really about sorcery or trees. It's the cult of saints. And it was this, and it's the same cult of saints and it's kind of presumed ubiquity that caused the Wahhabi scholars of the next century, of the 18th century and into the early 20th century, to look at the vast majority of the Islamic world as having sunk into polytheism. So for example, the Ottoman Empire was dismissed as a state of polytheism, as a state of shirk, into the early 20th century. There's a famous fatwa authored by the leading Wahhabi scholars in the time of World War I, where they're asked by a questioner, which side should we support in this war? Should we support the Christian powers or the polytheist Ottomans? And they say, oh, well, they're both pretty awful. Actually, the polytheist Ottomans are worse. But the best outcome would be for God to extend the war between them. So, I mean, it couldn't be clearer the way that they looked at the kind of the majority of the Islamic world.
Was there anything included in polytheism outside of the cult of saints that was like consequential? So maybe there's these other, but when we read the original epistles and the documents, did he have in mind more things for cult of saints, or is that just kind of how it started to evolve later? Or this is like the central and main theme that he was including in polytheism?
I mean, it's the theme that that he was obsessed with. Mm. I mean, we could put it that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, so here I have a line here. This is from this 1742 epistle. Mm-hmm. It gives you an example of the kinds of things that he's mentioning. So he says, so reflect, may God have mercy on you, on the supplication, the dua of other than God in times of hardship and in times of comfort that has afflicted mankind. So this saying, reflect on the extent to which people are appealing to these saints all the time in our modern day. Such and such a person intends to travel. And so he goes to the grave of a prophet or someone else. He comes to it with his wealth and his money in order to avert robbery. And such a person is afflicted by hardship on land or on sea. And so he seeks the help of Abdul Qadir, who's a saint in Baghdad, or Shamsen, that's a saint in Najd, or a prophet or a saint, that he may relieve him of this hardship. But this is, you know, it's his routine early Wahhabi polemic against the cult of saints. That was the main grievance. And certainly it develops from there. You know, they expunge the so-called polytheism from the area, and then the state expands and it starts to encroach on the outer rim of the Ottoman Empire.
So it's interesting. You mentioned that his message was one that was divisive and disruptive intentionally, and this dichotomy of community of belief versus community of unbelief. I guess it's one thing to say, look, don't do that, or we should be better, or we should aspire to not be polytheist or things like that. But it's pretty, in certain moments, we'll come to the four major elements in a minute, but it seems, I mean, again, I'm not reading this in original language, but based on from what you discussed in the book and everything, aggressive. Like, it's intense.
Yeah.
It's not just like, no, like, if you don't do this, like, there should be consequences. We should, you know, in some cases, violently take care of this. Like, why that level? It's one thing to feel passionate about something, but why to this very intense level? What do we make of that extent and what is he using to support those potential aggressive actions?
Well, without being psychological about it, I mean, I can't decode what was in Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab's brain.
Sure.
You know, just based on what he wrote.
Yeah.
My strong impression is that he was deeply committed to his belief in Islam as he understood it, and that Islam was an aggressive religion. It was not a religion that was quietist, that suffered fools, that suffered polytheists, you could say. And if you look at the way that the Prophet is depicted in some of the early Islamic sources, some of the canonical Muslim sources, and Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab would cite these frequently, they do not depict a kind of quietist type prophet. He was a disruptor. The Prophet Muhammad, even when he was in Mecca. So that this is actually an interesting facet of his preaching that I try to bring out in the book. So there, we often have, when we're taught about Islam, that there were two phases of his career. There was the preaching that he did in Mecca, which was peaceful and where he was persecuted. And then there was the preaching that he did in Medina, where he formed a state and he was also a military figure. And the preaching there is more, you could say, aggressive. Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab didn't accept that. His view was that Prophet Muhammad in Mecca was aggressive, that his preaching, that he intended his preaching to be offensive to the people around him. And there's a line from the Sirah, or the traditional biography of the Prophet, that he would quote frequently in his text. So I'll just read it here briefly. So this is from the Sirah. The leaders of the Quraysh, this isn't a quote by the Prophet. It's a quote by the leaders of the community in Mecca, who are upset with the preaching of the Prophet Muhammad. So they go to his uncle, who is his protector, and they say to him, "Your nephew has reviled our gods, denounced our religion, derided our traditional values, and told us that our forefathers were misguided." So for Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab, he cites that, and in one text he says, "In the lesson of the Prophet's preaching in Mecca is therefore this, quote, Islam is not sound without showing enmity to the polytheists. If one does not show them enmity, then he is one of them, even if he has not committed shirk, polytheism." And another quote similar to that is, "A person's religion and Islam are not sound, even if he professes tawhid and eschews shirk, unless he shows enmity to the polytheists and openly professes enmity and hatred of them." So he's saying these lines with reference to the Prophet's preaching in Mecca. So, I mean, that's the kind of understanding of the religion that he had. And so once he came into possession of some political power with the rise of the first Saudi state, he saw absolutely no problem that the mission of that state should be to spread Islam, the true version of Islam as he understood it, and to do so aggressively, and to therefore to prosecute jihad across the Arabian Peninsula and potentially beyond.
It's very illustrative of some of the content there. It's very, very fascinating. I have a thought about that, but I'll save that for a little bit later. I want to mention this because you mentioned it quite consistently throughout the book, and I think it's important to mention. With all this said, in the early days and throughout, Wahhabism gets its very fair share of critics, people that are anti this whole movement. From the beginning, this isn't like something that's like 200 years later or something. Right? This is something that is pretty early on. What were their counter arguments to this? What were they upset about, these people that were anti for this whole movement? What was the kind of tenor? This wasn't necessarily people, you know, with open arms believing this. There was a lot of resistance here. And at the end, there is, you know, people that believe in it, of course. But how was that initially, and how has the criticism continued?
Yeah, the refutations of Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab and his doctrine began almost immediately with his preaching. As soon as the epistles by him began to spread to areas outside of Najd, to the Hijaz in the west of Arabia, to southern Iraq and Basra, to eastern Arabia and Al-Hasa, the scholars there were infuriated, and they took pen to paper and they wrote. And oftentimes, thankfully, from the standpoint of the historian, they also quoted the entirety of the epistle that Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab had written, so that you can reconstruct what Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab wrote. And because those refuters, they put dates on their compositions, one's also able to kind of put a date on, or terminus post quem, as we can say, on the particular epistle in question. There are numerous things that the refuters would say. Perhaps the most was the most consistent was the idea that Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab was pronouncing takfir or excommunication on Muslims. And this is a major no-no in Islamic law. And there was a tradition attributed to the Prophet that one who that wrongly pronounces takfir on a Muslim, the accusation redounds on him. So it's a very dangerous territory to, you know, issue these kind of blanket accusations of takfir, as Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab did. And so they saw what he was doing as completely antithetical to the idea of Sunni Islam, which is predicated on the Jama'ah, or the group, the larger group society. And so that was one line of criticism. You're a mukaffir. You're obsessed with takfir, and therefore you're a heretic for doing that. Another was to associate him because of that practice with the Kharijites, a movement that were known for their indulgence of takfir and fighting fellow Muslims. That was another theme. Another was to quote a passage of his that in which Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab seems to say that he's getting his understanding of Islam from on high, in the form of a blessing from God. So they therefore called him Mutanebbi, or a kind of wannabe prophet. So they said that he's acting like a prophet. And in many ways, he was kind of acting like a prophet, but that was they made fun of him. They belittled him. They said things like, you're not qualified to engage in ijtihad and making deductions from the foundational Islamic sources of the Quran and the Sunnah because you don't meet the scholarly qualifications that had been established by Muslim scholars over the centuries, which indeed he did not. And he claimed, he would respond, I am not a mujtahid. I don't claim to have the ability to do that. And that's not what I'm doing. I'm actually just trying to stop you all from practicing polytheism. So you can imagine it's kind of a dialogue of the deaf when you start reading it, because they don't understand, it seems to me, where Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab is coming from. Now, a lot of them, the main disagreement between the different kinds of refuters had to do with the sort of scholarly authority to whom Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab most consistently appealed, and that was Ibn Taymiyyah. So he was a Hanbali scholar, meaning belonged to the Hanbali school of law, and the Wahhabis come out of the Hanbali school of law. So they have this attachment to Ibn Taymiyyah and his theology.
They were mostly traditionalists, right? That's the impression I get.
Yeah, they're traditionalist theology, meaning they don't adhere to one of these rationalist philosophical schools of speculative theology, which the Shafi'is and the Hanafis and the Malikis did. So that's the other schools of law. And most of his refuters were Shafi'is, just because of the demographics of the area. And so they would often resort to long citations of refutations against Ibn Taymiyyah. So they would just kind of, these refutations, some of which stretch on to hundreds of folios, that comes out to even more hundreds of pages in text on a computer, they're kind of rehashing these polemical or theological debates from the 13th and 14th centuries, which can get, and to me, is very interesting. So for one group of refuters, just to put it, to wrap it up, for one group of refuters, Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab and Wahhabism were little more than the revival of Ibn Taymiyyah, and his school of thought, which was deeply controversial in its time. For another school of refuters, namely the Hanbali refuters, who were the ones most close theologically to Ibn Abdul Wahhab, Muhammad Abdul Wahhab was misusing and misquoting Ibn Taymiyyah and taking his ideas in a direction in which they were not intended to go. So my own view is that it's somewhere in the middle.
That's very interesting. I meant to ask you this earlier, but you're talking about Taymiyyah. Where does Sufism fit in here?
Can I just say one more thing? I think I didn't quite do justice to the kind of tone of some of these refutations.
Sure, yeah.
They're extremely brutal. Mm. You know, some of them would say, this man is insane. he ought to be treated with medication. I mean, first of all, he needs to be detained. They need to understand whether or not he needs medication. And if he won't recant from his insane points of view, then he should be killed in order to save the Muslims from this man's heresy. And so and people were calling from his head even before he was engaging in any form of violence. So that's the kind of just how polarizing a figure this was. People wanted him killed from Basra to Mecca, Medina, and in East Arabia, and even people in his own communities in Najd, they wanted him killed. And they were looking for an authority that could come in and do such a thing, but they were not able to succeed. Sorry, I cut you off at Sufism.
Yeah, well, I wanted to know where that fits in here. Let me just remind people what Sufism is, and then where does that fit here with Wahhabism?
Yeah, so Sufism is the mystical dispensation in Islam, often associated with a so-called Sufi path to enlightenment. Often it's associated with the Sufi orders in which one takes on a master, a sheikh or a pir in Persian or Turkish. And so it's kind of an alternative spirituality to sort of the legalistic form of Islam that is, you might say, is the kind of mainstream and what is expected of everyday Muslims. So it's kind of, most of what Muhammad Abdul Wahhab wrote was not kind of deeply hostile to Sufism, as in the sense that you know, Sufism can be defined in multiple ways. For some people, it's simply just it's kind of ascetic practices, which for the Salafis and the Wahhabis are not like, it's not a huge deal. But Sufism also does have this strong historical connection. Particularly what is sometimes called esoteric Sufism, the Sufism of Ibn Arabi and certain kind of more heterodox thinkers. It was associated and closely connected to the cult of saints. And to that extent, and some of the Sufi masters would become kind of namesakes of Sufi orders, and their shrines would be centers of visitation. And so to that extent, Sufism was bad, according to the Wahhabis. But generally, they didn't polemicize against Sufism as such. They polemicized against the cult of saints and the practices related to it.
It's very interesting. So there are these four major components you spend time, a very long chapter talking about. So maybe you can just kind of go through them. We can go through the kind of Saudi states, you know, briefly after that. But this is the kind of main central aspects here. So it's, forgive my pronunciations here, but it's the Tawhid?
Tawhid.
The Takfir, which you've already discussed. The third one,
Al-Wala Wal-Bara.
And Jihad. And there's two types of Jihad that you discuss. You talk about offensive Jihad and defensive Jihad. So yeah, maybe just kind of go through each of those, telling us what each of them are and how they were used, and then how Wahhab was able to use or expand upon these. You know, you've talked about the Taymiyyah as the big influence here. So maybe there's influence here on these four concepts, but then how he branches out and continues to use them differently or otherwise. And so, yeah, I mean, just kind of walk us through them.
Yeah. So in this chapter, which is, I think, called, I'm forgetting the name of it. It has to do with it's in the Taymiyyah background.
Yeah, the main component and the key components. Those two chapters, I think, is where it's
in. Yeah, this one's called the Doctrine of Ibn Abdul Wahhab: The Key Components. So in this chapter, I try to look at the sources of Ibn Abd al-Wahhab's, you know, doctrinal tenets and their relationship in particular to the thought of Ibn Taymiyyah. And as I alluded to before, the reason to bring up Ibn Taymiyyah is because he was so central to the early discussion and the early debate around Wahhabism. It ended up being, in large part, a debate over the interpretation of Ibn Taymiyyah's views and also the legitimacy of those views, whether he was beyond the pale or not. So my own view is that he selectively, that is Ibn Abdul Wahhab, he selectively interprets Ibn Taymiyyah in ways that I don't think he's doing it, say, disingenuously or anything like that, but he had, he puts a certain spin on Ibn Taymiyyah's theological ideas. And in some ways, he takes them and, you know, beyond where they Ibn Taymiyyah might have been comfortable seeing them go. But to begin with Tawheed, basically the view I come to here is that he was not misusing or radically reinterpreting Ibn Taymiyyah's understanding of Tawheed. So Ibn Taymiyyah, in his theological polemics, including against the cult of saints, but also against all sorts of different Muslim groups and Christians and Jews, he often referred to what he termed two versions of Tawheed, two kinds of Tawheed. So Tawheed in Arabic has the meaning of making God one, to make God one or to render God one. So monotheism in English kind of is more about belief, right? It's the belief in one God. It's not quite what the Arabic word Tawheed captures. So the two kinds of Tawheed that Ibn Taymiyyah distinguished between were, first of all, what he called Tawheed al-Rububiyyah, or the Tawheed of God's, I think it's lordship. I don't really use the translations very much. They sound terrible. But so Tawheed al-Rububiyyah, and the other is Tawheed al-Uluhiyyah. And basically, it comes down to this. Tawheed al-Rububiyyah means confessing a basic belief in monotheism, that there is a supreme being who creates the universe, who manages the affairs of the world. But that doesn't necessarily mean that if you hold that belief, that you devote yourself exclusively to the worship of that one God. You have to engage in that kind of tawhid is to engage in tawhid al-uluhiyyah, which is the tawhid of godship, as if you want to translate it. So it means to direct all forms of worship to God alone. And for Ibn Taymiyyah, as for Ibn Abd al-Wahhab, this was the key test of one's monotheistic belief, not whether one held a basic understanding of there being a supreme being, but whether one worshipped that being exclusively and without partner. So when it came to the cult of saints, Ibn Taymiyyah would say, well, if you're appealing to such and such a person in the ground for help in travel or for intercession with God in the afterlife, that constitutes appealing to what is apart from God, and therefore it is sharing in or assigning a partner to God, or it is shirk, and therefore you have not met the conditions of Tawheed al-Uluhiyyah, which is the true test of a Muslim. So basically, that this idea, whether Ibn Abd al-Wahhab is using the terminology of the two Tawheeds or not, and sometimes he does, sometimes he doesn't, but his indebtedness to Ibn Taymiyyah for this polemical device is quite apparent and really indisputable. And perhaps I should say, first of all, that I spend maybe half the book talking about Ibn Taymiyyah and the relationship between Wahhabism and Ibn Taymiyyah, because I think it's so fundamentally important to understanding the nature and origins of Wahhabism, but also because a lot of scholars in the West have discounted the impact of Ibn Taymiyyah on Ibn Abd al-Wahhab. And I think that that comes down to a rather, misreading of Wahhabism, or failure to read and appreciate what is sometimes not said. So, for instance, if you just look at some of Ibn Abd al-Wahhab's theological writings, if you're not deeply familiar with what Ibn Taymiyyah wrote, you'd have no idea that this is distinctive Ibn Taymiyyah type language. But if you've read enough Ibn Taymiyyah, I mean, the signs are extremely clear. Also, and then if you combine with that the fact that all of his contemporaries are saying, you're stealing this from Ibn Taymiyyah, I mean, the fact is, Ibn Taymiyyah is kind of like, you can't understand what Ibn al-Duhab was all about without Ibn Taymiyyah. So that's Tawheed. Then my basic conclusion is that he hasn't really radicalized that part of Ibn Taymiyyah's thinking at all. Although he does, the difference between Ibn Taymiyyah and Ibn al-Duhab in this respect was that Ibn al-Duhab was composing treatises, or like basically what I call them epistles, or sometimes I call them catechisms. They're basic principles of creed that are, you know, watered down to their bare bones so that even lay Muslims can, if not read them, understand them when they are read aloud to them. And they're also intended to be memorized. So that sort of outreach in starting a movement was unique to Ibn Abd al-Wahhab. The next of these four components is, I think, takfir, which means in Arabic to declare somebody to be an unbeliever, a kafir. And generally speaking, we're talking about declaring professed Muslims to be unbelievers. So there's a key line from Ibn Taymiyyah where he says that I am one of the people most averse to making a pronouncement of takfir on a Muslim. I think he's probably wrong in saying that. A lot of what he said was very divisive and sectarian. But at the same time, there are many places in his writings where he makes allowances for particularly lay Muslims. And saying that those people can be excused their errors, the errors of their conduct, if they are indulging in, say, polytheism and the cult of saints, because they don't know better, because they're ignorant, and therefore they can be excused on the basis of ignorance. So this is a concept in Arabic known as al-udhr bil-jahl, or to excuse on the basis of ignorance. And one finds this quite commonly in Ibn Taymiyyah's writings. But when you look at what Ibn Abd al-Wahhab had to say, it was completely different, at least in certain key places. He wasn't particularly consistent on this, but the writings that had the most impact on the Wahhabi movement's development were based on the idea that there was no excusal on the basis of ignorance when it comes to matters of fundamental belief. So he was willing to dismiss broad swaths of Muslims, professed Muslims, as unbelievers to pronounce takfir on them on the basis that they were not owed any excuse on their on the grounds of ignorance. So that's a major disagreement when it comes to takfir. So, and then another part of the message that Ibn Abd al-Wahhab had on takfir was that it was a duty for good Muslims to pronounce takfir on wayward Muslims or those seen as committing polytheism. So, and you say, if it's a duty, well, then that does that mean that if I don't engage in it, am I a kafir? And these are the sort of questions that are ambiguous in Wahhabi theology, but that come to play quite a divisive role in the jihadi movement, in the early 20th century, with different factions within ISIS, for example, saying that, oh, you're not pronouncing takfir on these people, therefore you're a kafir. That kind of logic follows from the Wahhabi mainstream. Turning to what's the third one? Al-wala wal-bara'. So al-wala wal-bara' is a phrase that captures a duty known as, if I translate it, it's association and dissociation, or loyalty and disavowal. And basically what it amounts to is a duty that is found in certain of the foundational Muslim texts that says you have to associate and show loyalty exclusively to fellow Muslims, and to dissociate from and show hatred and enmity to non-Muslims, namely unbelievers, polytheists, what have you. So this concept is elaborated, and not just in Ibn Taymiyyah, but in many other parts of the Islamic tradition, Islamic scholarly tradition, not just within Sunnism, by the way, too, but also Shiism and Kharijism. But there is a particular emphasis on it in Ibn Taymiyyah's writings. The difference is that when he's writing about it, he's not thinking in terms of population level takfir and therefore population level exhibition of hatred and enmity. So what Ibn Abd al-Wahhab has done is expanded the scope of a lot of the polemical devices that were being used by Ibn Taymiyyah to kind of cast his net at a larger set of targets. And the same applies to, I think, what is the final element of these four, and that is Wait, hold on.
Jihad.
I'm trying to remember. Jihad. Yes, jihad. So jihad, in most of what Ibn Taymiyyah wrote about jihad is not particularly controversial or unique. He believed that, he theorized essentially two kinds of jihad. One known as jihad ad-dafa, which is a defensive jihad, that is a duty binding on the Muslim community. So it's an individual duty, fard al-ayn, and offensive jihad, or missionary jihad, something in Arabic that is called jihad at-talab, or the jihad of seeking out the enemy, which is the kind of jihad that one engages in, usually under the aegis of a properly formed Islamic state, to spread the word of Islam and to fight the unbelievers, at least in one campaign, at least once a year. So that's the idea of offensive jihad. However, there's one unique thing about Ibn Taymiyyah's approach to jihad, which had to do with the jihad that he was engaged in, at least rhetorically, and that was the Mongols who were sacking Damascus and raiding the Fertile Crescent during his time. So the Mongols had converted to Islam, but Ibn Taymiyyah didn't really believe that they had. So it was a nominal conversion. And so there was some dispute, however, among the people of the Mamluk Sultanate that Ibn Taymiyyah lived in about the legitimacy of fighting those who acknowledged Islam. And so Ibn Taymiyyah basically said, well, they're not following the laws of Islam. Therefore, they're not really, to be perceived as Muslim. So some of that argument does make its way into Wahhabism. But in my personal opinion, it's not central to what Ibn Abd al-Wahhab was arguing. So what he argues with respect to jihad is that once he's made this alliance with Muhammad bin Saud and Diriyya in about 1744, there began to be a number of battles between Diriyya and neighboring towns. And the way that the Wahhabi tradition in the chronicles and in the writings of Ibn Abd al-Wahhab himself, the way that this is depicted is in terms of defensive jihad. Particularly the town of Riyadh had launched a campaign of aggression against an ally of Diriyya, and therefore there was this long campaign of defensive jihad against the aggressive ruler of Riyadh. So in the early part of Muhammad Ibn Abd al-Wahhab's preaching then in Diriyya, he's engaged in supporting defensive jihad. And you find that in his writings, in the epistles that he's exchanging with different people in the Middle East at the time. However, if one fast forwards about a decade or so, or not even a decade, I think it's only 8 years, one finds him in a different context, arguing in favor of jihad against neighboring towns on the grounds that they are refusing to accept Islam as he has articulated it and elaborated it in the, as we call it, Wahhabism. And they are refusing to submit to the rule of Muhammad bin Saud and Diriyya. And therefore, they must be fought because they have committed apostasy. And so he's citing, in this context, verses from the Quran that are associated with the duty of offensive jihad. So you find this development from defensive jihad to offensive jihad that mirrors, of course, the practice of the early Islamic state of the time of the Prophet Muhammad, at least as the Islamic tradition preserves the story for us. And the same can be said about his early career in preaching. In the early part of Muhammad Ibn al-Wahhab's preaching, he sees himself very much in the role of Muhammad in Mecca, where he's kind of preaching this aggressive sort of, and there's also a part where he's kind of preaching in secretive, which is also related to the model of the Prophet Muhammad. So there are many ways that one can read him as following in the footsteps of the Prophet, which is one of the chapters, I think the subtitle or one of the titles of one of the chapters of the book.
Yeah, it's interesting. The components are important because I think that's kind of the kind of meat of the doctrine and following. So I'm glad that you went over that. I guess just briefly, you talk about these three Saudi states. You have the first Saudi state you know, 1741 to 1818. And you talk about in that first one, this move from secretive preaching, public preaching, voluntary defensive jihad, obligatory defensive jihad to offensive jihad, and very much kind of emulating the Prophet's trajectory as well. And it turns out that Egypt defeats first Saudi state. And then you get to the second Saudi state, 1823, 1887, and the Ottomans come online here in the second Saudi state. And then you get the third one, which is more recent, 1902, 1932. And there's some kind of up and down elements there. So maybe just kind of give us, I mean, obviously, you know, it's a lot of history there, but just kind of give us the overall snapshot of these kind of iterations of there's different Saudi states and there's different periods, there's different players involved. But what's the kind of ebb and flow of how these states arise and then they fall, they arise, they fall? Is it just geopolitical? Is there some theological components? And how does Wahhabism kind of pierce through all of those?
Yeah, so I would say that the first Saudi state, which lasts from approximately 1744 to the year of its destruction, 1818, with the sacking of Diriyah by the forces of Mehmed Ali of Egypt, that version of that iteration of the Saudi political project was the most devoted to Wahhabism. Mm.
And because it was because he was a part of it. It was very close to it. That is that part of the reason why?
I think that's a big part of the reason why. Mm. The second ruler of the Saudi state, I think its name is Imam Abdulaziz ibn Muhammad al Saud. He was a student of Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab. Mm. And I believe he also married his daughter. I mean, a lot of intermarriage is an interesting feature of this part too. So we have, I think, a tendency to look at the current way that the Saudi state is structured and to kind of project that back onto the past. Mm. And so, of course, what you have today, or at least until very recently, was a Saudi monarchy that ruled in a partnership with the Wahhabi clerics. But, you know, is the Saudi monarchy really committed to this version of Islam? I mean, we know that they, you know, tend to drink wine in the West and things like that. If you look at what the texts tell us and show us about the 18th century version of Wahhabism and what the Saudi rulers were like, it shows that they were deeply committed to this version of Islam and to spreading it. And after Abdulaziz is killed, and I think it's around 1802, his son Saud, he becomes the most aggressive of all the Saudi rulers, and he begins raiding in southern Syria and southern Iraq. And there's also, of course, the famous sacking of Karbala, which is a Shiite shrine in southern Iraq that the Wahhabis famously, destroy and steal from, pillage, etc. But beyond that, there are a series of letters that were exchanged between the Imam Saud, as he was known, the leader of the Saudi state named Saud, in the early 1800s, and the Ottoman governors of Baghdad and Damascus. And basically what Saud wrote to them was that you people don't practice Islam. You practice polytheism. Mm. And here, I'll explain what Islam is. And he would just kind of summarize Wahhabi creed. And then he would say, and so if you want to accept what I have to say, then you will be our brothers in faith. If not, then we will fight you. And he quotes here a statement that's preserved in the Islamic tradition by the Prophet Muhammad, which is a letter from the Prophet to the leader of Byzantium, Heraclius, called Heracle or Heraclius, where he says, accept Islam and you will be safe. Otherwise, the sin of the husbandman will be upon you. And this is broadly understood in the Islamic tradition to mean that the Prophet was foreshadowing his campaigns, the campaigns of early Islam against Byzantium and other empires. So basically what the early Saudi rulers were doing when they looked at the Ottoman southern periphery as they were conquering northward was that they were going to repeat the experience of the early Islamic state in conquering this empire that professes polytheism. And So, and there's no reason for them not to think that, I think, in large part because there hadn't been a state-like project that came out of NEJD in hundreds of years. Really, I think like 8 centuries or something like that. It's really a remarkable development that there was ever a state that came out of NEJD that grew to this size and that had just conquered Mecca and Medina. So, I mean, that's kind of the character of the early Saudi state that comes through from the writings, not just of the Wahhabi clerics, but from the Saudi leaders themselves. The character of the Saudi state in the second Saudi state is very different. The leaders seem to be much more, averse to conflict with neighbors. They're more circumspect. From all appearances, they seem to be devoted to Wahhabism, but not, you know, in an aggressive missionary way. They host foreign, that is Western, ambassadors in the capital, in Riyadh. And generally, they're just not as, you know, aggressive. However, the Wahhabi scholars that they promote and that they are, you know, sometimes co-authoring epistles with, they haven't changed their positions whatsoever. And so they still continue to see the outside world beyond Arabia as predominantly one of shirk and unbelief. So that's the second Saudi state. And then there's a long civil war that begins in the 1860s. And the Saudi state is not nearly as successful in its second iteration. And then there's this period that I refer to as the Rashidi interregnum between, I think it's 1887 and 1902, when there was another dynasty that was regnant in Arabia known as the Al-Rashid, they ruled from the northern town of Hayl, and they were much less disposed positively to Wahhabism. And there are many anecdotes that I try to bring out in the book that illustrate that. But the Wahhabi scholars at the time, they didn't really know what to do because they didn't have a Saudi patron anymore. So they tried to maintain the severity of their doctrine. They argued in numerous polemics that if one was a true Muslim, that meant that one could not travel to places like Egypt, Syria, and Iraq, because those were places where polytheists were dominant, and one could not be in a place where polytheists were dominant unless one, being a good Muslim, was willing and able, and in fact eager, to show hatred and enmity to those people. And supposing that showing them hatred and enmity would invite their wrath, then he couldn't possibly be in that territory. And that's an argument that is repeated over and over and over again from the early 18th century into the early 19th century to the early 20th century. The prohibition on travel to lands considered quote unquote lands of unbelief or lands of polytheism. And that included the entirety of the Ottoman Empire. So that's the third Saudi state, something of a different animal, because there was a very interesting ruler named Abdulaziz who begins the third iteration of the Saudi political project in 1902 by coming to Riyadh from Kuwait with a handful of supporters and reestablishing a Saudi family rule in Nejd. And in doing so, he kind of repeats the earlier model of the first Saudi state. He brings the scholars together. They invoke him as the extension of the earlier Saudi rulers who promoted Wahhabism in Arabia and beyond, and they saw him as a puritanical Muslim ruler who would, you know, just kind of chart the same path as before. But Abdulaziz was smart and worldly, and he understood that if I'm going to have a state in the world as it was coming into being at the time, I'm going to have to accept certain international norms and conventions, like borders, like treaties with foreign powers. I'm going to manage my affairs carefully. I'm going to listen to the scholars when it suits me. I'm going to ignore their advice when it doesn't suit me. So for instance, there's a famous case where oil prospectors, oil businessmen are operating in the kingdom. And this is probably in the 1920s, word of this reaches the leading Wahhabi scholars in Nejd. And so they write to King Abdulaziz to say, you know, this is against Islam. You can't have people like this in Islam. You're the ruler of a Muslim state. This is unacceptable. And he just ignores them, and there are many interesting, witnesses to Abdulaziz's kind of conduct with the scholars and the way that he kind of was able to put them in their place, but also kind of set them up with a pretty powerful bureaucracy. And so he gave them sort of as David Cummins in his book on Muhammad says, he gave them a half loaf, but this, the Wahhabi scholars came to understand that a half loaf wasn't so bad. They were able to kind of continue to elaborate Wahhabi doctrine in an unreconstructed manner. When it came to, their affairs with the outside world, it was impressed on them that they were no longer going to characterize the larger Muslim world as a world of polytheism and unbelief. They were actually going to interact with that world. They were going to try to make good with it and to persuade that world that their beliefs were the right beliefs. Even by accepting that that task, the scholars were admitting that they couldn't adhere to their puritanical ideals in the way that they did in earlier periods. And so that's what I begin to call the watering down of Wahhabism, not so much in theory as in practice. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's quite fascinating, and I'm really, really glad that you gave us the core principles. I know we kind of summarize the kind of states, but my last question for you is, we started with kind of today and kind of what it looks like in the landscape of it today. But I guess, why do you think this has persisted for 250, 300 years? And, with the current state of things in Arabia with MBS and just generally, do you think it still persists? At least in practice, or maybe even in belief? What do you think is the future of this kind of belief system?
Well, I think that the main appeal of Wahhabism over the centuries, and one of the reasons why it has been sustained over a long period of time in an area with harsh conditions without strong natural resources until the advent of oil, of course, but that's much later. Is that it's a persuasive to certain readers, certain listeners, a version of Islam. It's simple, it's direct, it engages with the sources of revelation. It doesn't require any kind of high philosophical thinking. It sets out principles in ways that are simple and direct. And I think that it also kind of appealed to the layman in a way that it was empowering. Because, this is a time when Muhammad al-Wahhab was preaching that very few people could read and write. They weren't taught to, they were taught to read the Quran, but they weren't, they weren't taught that they were, able to interpret it. That was the job of the jurists, these, elite, enigmatic men of learning. And Ibn Abdul-Wahhab was, he had a kind of populist appeal because he said that, to hell with their authority. They don't know what they're talking about. They're, we don't have to listen to them anymore. And so that kind of appeal, that kind of, I don't know what the right word is, but the insouciance of it, the idea that you're going to have direct contact with the sources of revelation, I think is empowering. And once you've accepted those tenets, it's, there's a certain logic to them, consistency, and, but it requires hardcore believers. And whether they continue to exist in Saudi Arabia, I don't have any information that would lead me to believe that they don't exist at all. I mean, there was a time when I believed that, hardcore Wahhabis represented, a strong plurality of the Saudi population. MBS is trying to change that. And that begins with the educational system. They've removed a lot of the more hardcore Wahhabi views. If you look at a Saudi religious textbook today that's taught in high school, for example, and I've been to the Ministry of Education and had discussions about this with them, it's very much infused with the ideas of Ibn Taymiyyah, but not the more hard-edged views of Ibn Abdul-Wahhab. And the history books are being rewritten right now to remove Muhammad Abdul Wahab is a central character. He's been being demoted to, at most, a bit player in what is a drama that begins and ends with the Saudi royal family and its genius. And that is a very different kind of national story that I think will have a strong impact on generations of Saudis to come. So I don't think we're at the end of this movement at all, but I think that the where it's going to kind of subsist to the extent that it will into the future is going to be in different kind of communities of fundamentalist Salafi type followers. And that includes the jihadis, who will always be most enthralled to the most militant and uncompromising version of Wahhabism.
Yeah, this is very, very fascinating. Cole, thanks so much for your time and your energy and for writing such an important and fascinating book. I greatly enjoyed it. And I enjoyed more how well you explained everything and laid it out for us. And so I'm deeply appreciative of that. And I really do thank you for coming on and having such a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely.